From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 800-462-7413. And along with your calls, we have some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes, drug costs. What does your drug cost? Is your pharmacy charging you the cheapest amount? And it's a very interesting study that shows that different drugs may cost different amounts in different cities. I think it's information anyone who buys any medication at a pharmacy should know about.
Yeah, interesting.
And coffee, Puritans, beware. There are perks to this story that you are not going to like. Coffee is good for you. Again, yes, one more for coffee.
Should we have coffee with our recipe?
Sweet and sour chicken rice bowl, absolutely delicious. And when you're done eating that rice bowl, sure, you can have a cup of Java.
Okay. Again, 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 1-800-462-7413. To the phones now, Zorba, a listener with us in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi there. Hi, Dr. Zorba. Hi, Tom. How are you too?
Okay. How can we help?
Great.
So I have a question. I recently was put on a medicine. It's the generic for Nuvigil or armodafinil for hypersomnolescence, I believe. And I started taking it. The medicine's effective, but I noticed, you know, that things seemed a little bit sharper. So I got on Wikipedia, because we all know Wikipedia is the Bible of all information. And it actually listed modafinil and armodafinil as nootropics or smart drugs. That got me thinking that, you know, maybe there was a secondary or some type of secondary benefit that I was receiving in addition to staying awake, and that was, you know, enhanced cognitive performance. And to give you a little background, about 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with a cavernous hemangioma in my right frontal lobe and had to undergo a craniotomy. That's taken me a long time to recover from, and I'm still not sure that I actually have fully recovered from it. And then earlier this year in February, I had a lumbar surgery and got methicillin sensitive staph aureus and became septic. So I was sick for quite a while, you know. So been recovering from both of those. You know, this medicine has helped me stay awake, but also cognitively. So I just wanted to know your thoughts on nootropics. I know there's some other ones out there too. Mainly the racetam or racetam family, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, let me jump in, Zorba. I don't understand most of what our listener was saying about the medicines and what they are for.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, your question is whether or not these drugs actually make you smarter. And the answer is no. Actually, nothing makes you smarter and more intelligent. First of all, let's look at really the class of drugs. These are all related. They're stimulants. So they're all related to meth. They're basically all related in some way to methamphetamines. We have to look at it. Now, they're a different class, so they're not actually in the same class of methamphetamines, but they're all related to that. And if we look at stimulants, look at the most common stimulant ever in the world that's used by many people every morning when they get up, and it's called coffee and caffeine and other products. And that is the most common stimulant. Really works, helps you get up in the morning, does things. I take it all the time. Non-addictive. If you look at Nuvigil or Provigil, Provigil actually is another drug within the class. Anything, first of all, Wikipedia has some good information, but let's remember anyone can edit it. So companies that manufacture the drugs, it's in their best interest to edit the drug that's on there, especially if it's a trademarked drug, so they're making money on it. So you got to take that information with a grain of salt. you know, if there were drugs that actually made you smarter, you would use it. Now, moving back to this a bit, if you look at students who are at Harvard, Yale, Dartmouth, the Ivy League schools, I would guess one third of them are in stimulants of one sort or another. Maybe they might be on Ritalin. They might be, on Adderall, which is a methamphetamine. They might be on Provigil, which is a drug, once again, different class. Nuvigil is the same. Provigil is now a generic, so they then manufactured a new one. And so these stimulants really help people concentrate, but they don't make them more intelligent. Now, the question for you, since you have had cranial surgery, do you feel better on it? Do you take it every day?
I do. Okay. And I'm not sure if it's a function of time and my own body's healing or my own brain's healing, or if this is just accelerated the process or enhanced it.
Yeah, I don't think it enhances healing or anything. I don't think there's any evidence. I mean, it might do it, but there's no evidence. There's no study that shows that. But people do respond to this. I have people who are on stimulants, and they've been using them for years. They've been using them. We give them for ADD. And so they use them in their job when they become adults. There are a number of adults who need stimulants in order to do their work. It is not uncommon. This is a stimulant of a different form. As long as you're not abusing it, that's always the other side of any stimulant, but I assume you're just taking the same regular dose every day?
That's correct.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Now, I do have physicians who would disagree with me. There's no doubt about it. They would say, wait a minute, got to use the regular, if you take this every day, you're going to become habituated to it. The person's become addicted to it. All of a sudden, they can't function without it. The answer is, if you decide to stop it, you have to taper off of it with a doctor's sort of thought. You take it probably every other day, every third day, and then you stop. And it will take a while for your brain to sort of get back to its normal receptivity. And that a while could be 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, something like that. But the fact is, you've had brain surgery, and if this helps you think and concentrate and it improves your quality of life, I would recommend you stay on it. But it doesn't make you smarter. Your IQ test would be exactly the same with or without it. You just might finish it quicker because you're on the drug.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And congratulations on that successful surgery. Those are hard. Brain surgery is very, very hard to recover from. It takes a while.
Oh, really? Thanks so much.
Thanks
we appreciate the call. At 800-462-7413.
Do you want to discuss your recovery? Can we do that or not?
Well, sure.
So, you had, because you had a subdural hematoma, which is blood sort of between the skull and the brain, you had brain surgery.
On both sides.
So you had to have that hematoma removed. How long did it take you for you to recover from that?
Will it take me? Is it?
But it does take a while. You did recover. It took you a while. You had trouble concentrating and doing things for a while, and you gave it a bit of time, and then you returned to your abnormal self.
Unfortunately. Let's change the subject. What does a drug cost? It depends on where you're living.
Well, this is fascinating. So first of all, for years, I've been talking about a website called Good, GOODRX.com. Take a drug. What you do is you sign on, log on, give yourself a username, give yourself where you live, your zip code. My zip code is 53575. Put the drug in, and it'll show you the different prices at different pharmacies. And if you're paying your regular price, you'll find out there's a huge difference between different pharmacies, a huge difference.
So do you have a list or something?
Well, the New York Times did a whole article, and they looked at 30 cities, 500 commonly used drugs, using the information from GoodRx.com. And lo and behold, the difference is enormous if you're paying for regular price. I want to give you some examples. Yeah. Different cities have different prices. That kind of shocked me. I mean, I thought maybe it'll cost more in Boston, but not as much, but it turns out to be different. So I'm going to give you some good examples. Metformin. Now, metformin is a commonly used diabetes drug. It is a generic, okay? In San Francisco, it costs $49.36 for a typical prescription. Mm-hmm. What do you think it costs in Boston?
I have no idea.
$23. Why is it less in Boston and more in San Francisco? Tamiflu, to treat influenza. Tamiflu, by the way, shortens the course of influenza by a day. Okay, doesn't really do very much. Mm-hmm. Does prevent influenza in families. It has. It's a very expensive drug. In San Francisco, it's a whopping $200. In New York City, not exactly a cheap place. It's $50 less than $155, so very expensive. Now, paroxetine. Paroxetine is Paxil. It's a generic drug. It should be inexpensive at all. In Columbus, Ohio, it costs $20. Yeah. Okay? In Birmingham, Alabama, it costs $50, yeah. Twice as much. And ondansetron, which is used for nausea, is off the wall in Birmingham, Alabama, at a whopping $356. And in Boston, it's half price at $169. This is absolutely
ridiculous. Makes no sense whatsoever.
No, no, it does make sense. What do you think the sense is? Money, profit, money, pharmaceutical company money, drugstore money, wholesaler money.
So it's
the
just
profit
they're
motive.
Charging what they can get, is
you
that?
Bet. Come on. What else could be explain this? You think because it's farther to get these pills to Birmingham, Alabama, than San Francisco? Give me a break. This is a whole financial thing. And part of it is the fact that you cannot go into the drugstore and say, how much does this drug cost? Because they don't always tell you. It's bogus, and it's wrong.
If you find out that it's cheaper somewhere else, you can't call that somewhere else.
No, you can't. I call pharmacies. I've done this in Walgreens. I'll say, how much are 30 pills of paroxetine? And they'll say, well, we can't tell you until we run it through. What do you mean you can't tell? Well, computer doesn't work unless you actually send over a prescription, and we run it through as if we're putting up a drug. Why do you think they're doing that? Because they want to obfuscate. I can finally use that word in a sentence. I've been trying for weeks. They can obfuscate what they're trying to do because they want to make more money on you, the consumer. Now, I'm not against capitalism. I am not a socialist.
This is ridiculous.
I'm not against.
So.
I'm just against being ridiculous. How do you, as a consumer, protect yourself? I have a simple answer.
Well, what?
GoodRx.com. I have no idea who owns that particular website. You go to GoodRx.com. You put in your zip code. You put in the drug you're going to have. It'll show you the difference between different pharmacies. They will also let you take a coupon to the pharmacy, which will give you the lowest possible price, and that's what
you
do.
You're still stuck with a pharmacy in your hometown.
Well, of course, but you go to GoodRx.com, and you'll see the difference. The difference can be $50 or $100. So if you're paying regular price, you should go to GoodRx.com, and you'll find a difference. And now you might think that Walmart is the cheapest. It is not always the cheapest. I've been shocked. Walmart, for some drugs, is more expensive than Target and CVS and even Walgreens. Now, it might be only a few dollars, but if you're paying for your drugs yourself, it's GoodRx.com. That's the thing that will save you because drug companies and drug stores are trying to fleece you.
That's ridiculous. If you buy a car in one city and you buy the same car in another city, it's about the same price.
Well, maybe the same price, but at least you can look at it.
A bag of potatoes is probably about the same.
A steak, at least you can look at it. I mean, at least they advertise their prices. Drug stores do not advertise their prices. Why? Because they can do it.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back to the phones. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a Wauwatosa, Wisconsin listener, is with us now. Hi.
Hi, Tom, Dr. Zorba.
How can we help?
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I had the kind of the weirdest thing. You know how we love the smell of coffee in the morning and all, but suddenly coffee just smells horrible to me.
Huh.
I still drink it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if I open a fresh bag or even in the coffee aisle, I grind my own beans.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm doing it, I breathe through my mouth.
Oh, wow. That's
so
pretty.
So I don't have to smell it.
That's pretty bad.
And
what about like, what about other things?
I felt like I've always had a great sense of smell, and I ride a bike a lot, you know, and orange trees, an orange grove, and smell the oranges, and it smells great. But I really haven't been able to pinpoint other things, but coffee. It's just
Food? Has there any change in food?
No, not really. I'm always looking to evolve my diet, and, I eat fairly well.
So foods do not taste bad to you. In other words, it's only coffee. It's not other foods, and your sense of smell has not decreased.
I don't think so.
You'd be the only one to know. You'd be the only one to know if your sense of smell decreases. And the reason I ask that is anosmia, which is the loss of a sense of smell, and we all develop it to some extent as we get older. But as we develop anosmia, certainly from certain problems such as head trauma, it can be with specific foods, where we actually do not smell the foods the way we used to, and there's a change in the way they smell them, and then foods just don't smell good. And usually that's at a point where things don't taste right. They actually don't taste good.
Holy cow.
Also, have you noticed anything else like that?
No, but I fell off of a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
I broke my collarbone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I really smacked my head.
Okay. When was that?
This was last summer.
Uh-huh, last summer. When did the coffee start tasting bad to you?
Oh, boy. I'm thinking, it's hard to pinpoint. Thinking November?
Mm-hmm. Could easily have been from that trauma. Could easily have been from the head trauma. The olfactory lobe can easily be affected. That's where we get our sense of smell.
Holy cow. By trauma,
by infection, by other things. So the whack on your head affected something that produced a change in coffee. It usually is more things than coffee. It's usually a bunch of other things. And there usually is a loss of a sense of smell. But it
does affect other things. I leave Wisconsin in November, mm-hmm. Out of the cold. But I go to, and this is a weird too, I go to Arizona, I spend most of my time there, and it sounds weird, but Arizona smells funny sometimes.
Oh, uh-huh. No, it doesn't sound weird. It sounds like it makes sense to me. Arizona smells funny to you when you get there from the whack on the head.
Holy cow.
And there's nothing you can really do about it. You can't do anything about it because it's a sensory within the olfactory, within the olfactory system. So you can't do much about it except to switch to tea. But come on, you don't want to switch to tea when you're a coffee drinker.
And I can still feel that little bumpish on my head where I smacked it.
Well, and it's inside the brain that occurred when you fell off. How high was the ladder? How high was your fall?
I was trimming some hedges,
mm-hmm.
and it's probably 10 feet.
Well, that's 10 feet is pretty high to whack your head. And when you whack your head, what happens is you whack your head. The brain is floating in a liquid. It goes against one side of the skull, and then it goes back to the other side, and it's called a contra coup injury. The coup injury is the first way it travels. The contra coup is when it goes backwards, and the olfactory lobe is sort of in the back, but it goes back and forth, and it may go back and forth more than once, depending on the trauma. And then you had some trauma, and if you did an MRI scan, no reason to do it. They might find that you had almost like a little stroke within that part of the brain that occurred. But that's what it was. I would guess it was trauma.
I did back then. I had a scan, and I went to the hospital and all, but it's unbelievable. It all makes sense now. Oh, God, I would never have related the two incidents.
Well, congratulations.
Holy cow. Now I thought it was just because I was getting old, doctor.
It ain't from getting old. It's from smacking yourself on the head, and you have to be more careful on those ladders. So.
Wow.
Thanks so much.
Good one. Thanks so much.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
Do you know what that means, Tom? What it means is if you hit your head, you may stop drinking coffee, too.
Are we going to keep on doing brain stuff for the rest of the hour? Before the break now, Zorba, I'm excited to introduce a brand new segment on the show. It will be dedicated to you, Zorba, a real-life doctor.
I just play a doctor on the radio.
Correcting or clarifying what a listener has read on the internet. We're calling it Google Doc.
We've got to get Jimmy Fallon to dance to that.
Absolutely. The following email came to us from a listener named Laquel. Dr. Zorba, I have a very confusing issue. When I drink lemonade, orange juice, margaritas, take vitamin C, drink too much coffee and tea without enough water, I encounter pain in my urinary tract. This is confusing because when reading online, it is suggested to take vitamin C to assist with an acidity imbalance in the body. It's supposed to help. Why is it causing this issue?
Well, first of all, I don't have the foggiest idea why it's causing the issue. There's some things that people go, I take this and I don't feel good from it. So why it should cause actual problems in the urine, I'm not sure. Certainly could be due to acidification of the urine, although I don't know where vitamin C would actually help with that. On the other hand, you know, there are things that we do not have not studied in medicine. And this is where going to Google and other things, you'll find out what other people say will work. And you know what? If you take your lemonade and you take your orange juice and you take a vitamin C tablet and it stops pain on urination, I say go for it.
So always believe what you find on Google.
You know, anytime, hey, if it's on the net, it must be real.
Did you read something?
And if you believe that, I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge.
Did you read something online that you're not quite sure about? Our real-life doc is here to clarify the clickbait. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org, and we promise we won't spam you.
Our recipe coming up along with more of your calls, of course, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX. The Public Radio Exchange. I'm Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Question for Zorba? Call 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, sweet and sour chicken rice bowl.
That's right. You like chicken.
I do.
You do. I mean, you like chicken. And yeah. Sweet and sour is nice, kind of a nice, wonderful sort of, for me, it's a very familiar
taste. Oh, yeah, I like it too, yeah.
Familiar kind of taste. And sometimes it's fun to go back to sort of, you know, familiar taste.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is kind of where this comes from. So one of the things you want to do is you're going to have a sweet and sour sauce. They're not all the same. So let me tell you something I do when I'm looking for a sauce that I like. I have an Asian grocery store that I go to that is my favorite store. And I will buy 3 or 4 bottles of the same thing. And then I'll taste them and see which one I like.
Oh.
And then that's the one that I ultimately use. And I use that, for instance, for a teriyaki sauce. I found the one that I like, and I've been using that for years because they all have a different taste.
That's interesting.
So you may choose a Vietnamese one. You may choose a Malaysian one. You may choose a Chinese one. You may choose a Thai one. And yes, you might have 4 or 5 bottles, so you can spend $10 maybe for the, you know, small bottles, maybe
good,
a little
good
bit
idea,
more.
Yeah.
But then you find a sauce that you like for your taste.
Yeah.
And then you can go and buy that every time. Because sometimes you'll go and you'll buy a sauce and you'll go, oh, I don't like this. I don't like the dish. And you don't realize it's the sauce, silly. That's the one to look at.
Yeah.
So go to an Asian grocery store, pick it up. It's the same, by the way, with salad dressings. If you're looking for a low-calorie salad dressing, for instance, I happen to love Paul Newman Light Caesar. I like their low-calorie salad dressing. Most of those salad dressings taste kind of gummy to me. I don't like the texture of them. You get 3 or 4, find what you like, and then you actually will start to use it. So it's very important. You're going to start out with 3 tablespoonfuls of sweet and sour sauce, and you're going to have additional sauce for serving. Find the one you like.
That's 3 big teas, sweet and sour sauce, plus additional for serving.
Now, we're going to use a tablespoonful of fresh ginger. When I buy ginger, I buy ginger root. I put it in the freezer. It lasts in the freezer probably for like 6 months.
Mm.
And what you do is you grate it frozen. So you take it out of the freezer and you grate it, and it's wonderful. And it's nearly as good. To me, it tastes just the same as fresh ginger. I would say it's really equivalent.
That's a big tea, fresh ginger.
Fresh or frozen ginger that you grate. 1 pound of boneless, skinless chicken breast halves. So 1 pound of boneless, skinless chicken breast.
Yeah. 1 pound of boneless, skinless chicken breast.
1 cup of pineapple chunks.
Cup of pineapple chunks.
Now, when you open up a can of pineapple and you take out the chunks, Tom, what do you do with the juice that's inside the can?
Huh?
You're not like Tom, and you want to do something with juice. I drink the juice inside the can. It's really, really good. Yeah. And yes, it is caloric, but pineapple is, like, delicious.
Mm-hmm.
12 ounces of broccoli florets.
12 ounces of broccoli florets.
That's right. You're going to sort of chop them up. Just put them in smaller pieces. Mm-hmm. A cup of red bell peppers seeded and chopped.
Cup of red bell pepper seeded and chopped.
And you're going to want to chop them into the size that you're going to want to eat them. They're not necessarily smaller, but. And 2 cups of brown rice, hot and cooked.
2 cups brown rice, hot and cooked.
Let's make the recipe. Mm-hmm. So preheat the oven to 425. Spray a baking pan, 15 by 10, a 1-inch baking pan, with nonstick cooking spray. Put it down to the side. Combine the sweet and sour sauce and ginger in a small bowl. Place the chicken pieces on the prepared pan and then brush them with the sweet and sour sauce mixture. Top with pineapple. Roast for 15 minutes. So you're roasting the chicken, the pineapple, and the sweet and sour. Remove the pan from the oven. Add the broccoli and pepper. Return it back to the oven and roast for another 10 to 15 minutes till the chicken is done. It has to be at about 165 degrees. Veggies are tender. Cut the chicken strips into bite-sized strips because you're going to start with these halves of chicken, so you're not going to chop them up. Divide the rice among the serving bowls. Top with the chicken and veggies and pineapple. Top with additional sweet and sour sauce. And bingo, you've got sweet and sour chicken rice bowl. Great for a family and great for company.
Yes. Sounds really good.
It's really good. And it's only got about 200, 220 recipes because, remember, boneless, skinless chicken breast is a high-protein item, which is low-fat and therefore has less calories than a lot of other things.
Got it. And if I would like this recipe?
Well, back in the old days, you actually would send us some mail with a stamp and a self-addressed stamped envelope. But in the new days, you don't actually have to do that. What you do is you go to zorbapastor.org, and you can see pictures of Tom, lots of recipes, my recipes, Tom doing funny things, although I don't know if those pictures are still on there. That's zorbapastor.org. or find us on Facebook. Don't you remember that party where you were dancing on the table, Tom, and we took photos?
You're making that up.
Uh-huh.
I know my brain doesn't work very well anymore, but you're making that up.
In your past memory, you never know what we have in our past memory. That's exactly it. Go to ZorbaPastor.org and, again, Facebook and find us.
Want to talk with Zorba? 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And back to the phones we go now, Zorba, a listener with us in San Antonio, Texas. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
My husband had a total colectomy about 3 years ago, and we've been concerned since the recovery of that about how we get proper nutrition in him. I've been reading and hearing a lot about gut health and the microbiome, and but knowing that all that stuff gets absorbed in your large intestine and everything runs through him pretty quickly,
sure.
We're not really sure what he should be eating and how to make sure he's getting the nutrition he needs. He still has problems with dehydration, obviously, and fatigue.
Right. So let's go back a bit. First of all, he had a total colectomy for what?
Colonic inertia.
Colonic inertia. How long did he have that for?
Several years. I would say like 14 years or something. It was quite a while.
I mean, this was the last thing they were going to do, obviously.
Exactly.
I mean, this is not something that's, you know, it's something that's done for that. How old is your husband?
He is 45.
45, okay. And what did he weigh before the surgery? What does he weigh after the surgery?
He's about the same. He's right around 200 pounds, give or take a few pounds.
Okay.
He actually did gain his weight back.
He gained his weight back. How much weight did he lose after the surgery? Quite a bit, a little bit?
Quite a bit, because there were complications. So the anastomosis failed, and there were emergency surgeries, and he had an ileostomy for 8 or 9 months.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so there were 5 major surgeries over that 9 months. So I would say he's really only been, and then he was reconnected. So it's only been about a year that he's been, you know, recovered.
Got you. Right, from that. So he had a rocky course. I mean, he had a seriously rocky course. What does he do for a living? Is he working?
He has an office job. It's not too stressful.
So. Not too stressful. Okay, because those are issues too. Exercise. What's he doing for exercise?
Mostly house projects at the moment.
House projects are exercise. Sure.
Yeah, we walk a lot and do some biking.
So what kind of a diet? Let's talk about his food. What sort of food do you eat? Do you follow more Mediterranean diet?
Well, Mediterranean would be ideal in some ways. He doesn't like seafood and fish, so we do eat some, like tuna patties, salmon patties. But mostly we try to do a lot of salads. We found that salad and plus a protein, so salad plus like a piece of grilled chicken or something like that, If we eat a lot of kale and spinach, he can digest that pretty easily. And lots of carrots.
Right.
He has a problem. You know, we'd like to go to a more plant-based diet, but he has a problem with beans are horrible for him.
Right.
He can eat in small doses. Mm-hmm. He can eat a lot of things.
Well, you've got to look at those. Problem. You've got to look at exactly the things that he can have because of his surgery. Does he tolerate lentils, by the way?
I don't know that he's tried much in the way of lentils.
Let me tell you some interesting research on lentils that I think is important and maybe something to see if you can add to his diet. There's recent research, it was a fascinating study, looked at lentils and looked at the glycemic index with lentils, and they looked at lentils that were mixed with potatoes, lentils that were mixed with rice. These are high glycemic index foods. When we eat them, they immediately go to sugar within our body. And lo and behold, with lentils, the sugar spike reduced by 30% eating potatoes and about the same amount eating rice. Just mixing some lentils in with potatoes seemed to make a difference. Lentils, by the way, are high protein. A cup of lentils is about 20% of the protein that you actually, 25% of the protein you need for the entire day. So one of the things you might want to look at, because – and lentil is actually – it's called a pulse, but it's really a bean. It's in that same kind of – it's a legume. And so you might want to introduce some lentils into the diet. It's a very traditional thing. It's used – lentils are used – eaten pretty much every day in India and in all of South Asia because they're inexpensive and they're protein. And they add a lot. Not a lot of lentils. Maybe half a cup or a quarter of a cup. And that might change his biome. He has a biome. He doesn't have the biome in the colon because he doesn't have the colon. But that's one thing I would look at. I would look at adding small amounts of lentils to see how that worked. What does he do for dairy products? Does he tolerate yogurt?
He doesn't really like it, but he can tolerate some dairy.
So yogurt is a wonderful. It really is. It's lactobacillus. It's organic, especially organic yogurt. Most yogurt actually may not be used with organic milk, but it is an organic product. And I would see if he can tolerate some yogurt and if he likes it. And once again, find a yogurt you like. And a lot of people like full-fat yogurt. I happen to love Trader Joe's full-fat yogurt. If I have yogurt, I don't want low-fat yogurt. I like full-fat yogurt. It just tastes better to me. And so you find something that works that's good. It has calcium in it. I would look at adding those things within the diet. And then it's a variety. That's the best way to do the biome. A variety of fruits and vegetables that he tolerates, the brighter the color, the more nutrients are in there. The brighter the color, the more nutrients. So in other words, iceberg lettuce has hardly any nutrients compared to spinach. And so color really guides you. But I would try those two things, yogurt and lentils, and see how he tolerates it. And that's very good for the biome that he has within his body.
He's been having a lot of issues with dehydration, too, and ends up drinking a lot of, like, Powerade Zero. I mean, at least he's not getting the calories. Is that okay?
Sure,
I mean,
Powerade Zero is fine. It's a non-caloric drink, and the reality is he has trouble with dehydration because he doesn't have a colon that's reabsorbing his water. I mean, that's the bottom line issue. How's his ileostomy? How's he handling it? Or he has an anastomosis. Doesn't have an ileostomy.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Thank goodness. Yeah, it's okay as long as he stays hydrated.
So, you know, whatever he needs to stay hydrated, he has to do, and he has to do it by the clock. In other words, I've got to drink this much during the day, and he's lucky to be alive, and that's good for him, and this is one of the things he does. But the Powerade is just fine because water probably after a while just becomes you want to have something added to it. So let us know. Try those two things. See how that works. And once again, bright foods are better than dull foods.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure. We appreciate that call. Thank you very much. 800-462-7413, our number. 1-800-462-7413. 462-7413. Before the break, Zorba, let's check in again now with your favorite do-gooders, the Grammar Police. Okay, Zorba, this one is actually from the Bob Police, and this is a first for the show. This correction comes from the show's producer, Carl Christensen. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Carl writes...
Oh, no. It's the Grammar Police, and they're nearby. I can see him. He's got this famous Grammar Police hat on him. That's right. And, of course, he's got the Grammar Police ring and the watch and the whole thing.
Carl writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, first of all, I love the show.
Oh, really?
I'm a longtime listener.
Oh, really?
First-time emailer.
I got it.
Well, actually, you and I have exchanged hundreds of emails. But that's not the point. The point is, I heard something on a recent show that I just couldn't let slide.
He actually listens to this show.
He has to. He doesn't keep his job.
He has to listen to the show, that's right.
You told a caller to take the advice of Bob Marley and don't worry, be happy. Look, I know what you meant, but I just have to point this out. The song Don't Worry, Be Happy is by Bobby McFerrin.
Oh, my goodness.
Bob Marley has a song called Three Little Birds that has the line, Don't Worry About a Thing. And I believe that's where the confusion occurred. And to further exhaust my point, because that's what the Grammar Police are trained to do, I had our technical director, Brad, put together a clip of both songs so you can hear how different they are.
Don't worry about a thing.
Note for note, don't worry. Be happy.
Singing, don't worry about a thing.
When you worry, you make it double. Don't worry.
Gonna be alright.
Don't worry, be happy now.
Producer Carl continues, so keep up the good work, Zorba. Once again, I love the show, and please don't fire me. Do you think Zorba got the artist's name for a song wrong because he was confused about somewhat similar lyrics? Let us know by posting to our Facebook page or sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up. Another topic to talk about, that's next. And we'll be quacking up with Dr. Zorba, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number is 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, coffee can boost the chances for longer life?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, for years, the Puritans in our society have tried to tell us that coffee is bad for us. Keep in mind that the Puritans' beverage of choice back in the 1600s before the Dutch introduced coffee was a glass of rum in the morning. So they have nothing to be proud of, those Puritans. But this is looking at coffee, and it's very interesting. It was 500,000 British. So the Brits, some are coffee drinkers, some are tea drinkers. Believe it or not, the Brits kids do not drink just tea. They also drink coffee. Mm-hmm. And this is a longitudinal study. And they looked at Brits who are basically consuming 8 cups of coffee a day. Now, you have to look at what a British cup is. It's not an American cup. It's like 6 ounces of coffee. Those Brits, you know, they have this
little tiny teacups.
You know, they don't have a cup of coffee. The Americans go for a robust coffee, and you're having a cup of coffee. It's probably equivalent to at least 2, if not in the morning. I probably have the equivalent of 3 British cups of coffee in the morning. Lo and behold, the coffee drinkers that were drinking 8 or so cups of British cups of coffee were 10 to 15% less likely to die 10 years later than the non-coffee drinkers. So in other words, the abstainers seemed to die sooner than the people who were drinking coffee. And it's quite interesting because it wasn't related to caffeine. A lot of the coffee drinkers were drinking a decaffeinated coffee. But coffee contains about 1,000 chemicals in it, antioxidants that seem to actually help keep your body from having damage. And it's what we call a salubrious. It's something that's very useful. So there were 10 million Brits in there, half of them men, half of them women, aged 40 to 70 at the time. They filled out a daily questionnaire about their coffee, and they looked at the coffee, and lo and behold, it looks like coffee will actually keep you alive longer. Now, this goes on the back of another study that showed coffee produced less diabetes. Mm. And once again, it's not the caffeine. It is the coffee.
Yeah, but now you drink a lot of coffee.
I'll tell you what I drink. In the morning, I probably drink the equivalent of a mug or two of coffee. That's what I drink in the morning. I then have a spot of coffee at noon, and then I have a spot of coffee at about 4 o'clock in the evening.
More likely to have extended life from this than
there's no doubt about it. I'm going to live to 120, and you're going to die in about a week. But, I mean, that's the difference of it.
Let me try and be really serious. Does it matter how much coffee you drink?
According to this study, the answer is yes. According to this study, you should drink more coffee. Around 6 to 8 cups will make a difference. So, you know, and I don't drink coffee because I think I'm going to live longer. I drink it because I like the caffeine, I like the buzz of coffee, and I love the taste, and now I might live longer.
1-800-462-7413, our number, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a Hillsboro, Wisconsin listener, is with us now. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
My husband was just diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and he's Hispanic, and they told us to avoid tomatoes, onions, and garlic. Well, those are the 3 main ingredients in Mexican food. So I'm looking for some ideas on how to cook for my kids and stuff.
Well, there are a couple things, first of all. If he has tomatoes, onions, or garlic, does it disturb his gut?
Well, we're trying to figure that out now because he's having a lot of problems now. Even on the medication they gave him, he's constantly in pain with his stomach. And
Well, first of all, with Crohn's disease, there can be individual differences. So let me say, he may not be in a lifetime of tomatoes, onions, and garlic. So it's not necessarily forever. People with Crohn's disease, many of them can eat a lot of the foods that they want to eat once they get under control. When was the diagnosis first made?
It was last month, but he's been having problems since 2014.
Okay, so he's had the problems for a few years. What do they have him on? Do they have him on steroid enemas? Do they have him on pills, injections?
They have him on pills, sulfasalazine.
Right, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Salicylate, which really is, or sulfasalazine, which is a pill. How are his symptoms? A little better, a little worse, about the same?
They're still the same, which I was just reading on it, and you know, he's not supposed to be in direct sunlight with this pill, and he works construction, so he's out in the hot sun all day.
Well, by the way, when they put things like that on the medication, no direct sunlight, they're doing a few things. First of all, some pills can make you light sensitive, so you burn. So what you do is you put on sunscreen. You find a sunscreen that you will use because they're different. You find a spray. I like the spray. I don't like the cream. It's too tacky for me. Something for your face. So you do that. And the other thing is he may not be sun sensitive. It may only affect 5 or 10% of the population, but they put that on the label because they don't know if you're the 5 or 10%. So if he's not affected by it, he probably doesn't have to worry. But I would recommend sunscreen in any case, especially if he's out there you know, out there in construction all the time. Getting back to the problem, initially you want to get the symptoms under control. Either there are many different drugs that are used in Crohn's disease. You want to get them under control. And once they're under control, then you want to introduce foods and see if you can tolerate them. So I don't think it's forever. He's not having tomatoes, onions, and garlic.
Yeah.
But he may discover that he can tolerate some tomatoes, can't tolerate a lot of tomatoes, some onions, some garlic, because sometimes it's a dose response. The more you take, kind of the worse you can be. But he's early on in this. When does he see his doctor next?
He doesn't have an appointment because he works so much. Mm-hmm. He hasn't been keeping up. He's was supposed to go in for blood work and stuff, but he's afraid of needles.
Uh-huh.
So I'm working on him because he also was, when they did the test at the beginning, he's borderline diabetic and his cholesterol is really high.
Okay, so there's some other issues. Is he afraid? Has he fainted when he had his blood drawn?
Yeah, when I had my son, I had to hold his hand because he couldn't handle it.
So one of the issues is, and this is for people who really have problems having their blood drawn, and that's about 10 to 15% of the population, is when you have your blood drawn, you go there and you say, I have to lay down. You can't, you don't faint laying down. I mean, it can happen, but it's extremely rare. You lay down, the blood is drawn. You don't like it because the blood is drawn. And then you lay there for a minimum of 1 to 2 minutes. You don't get up right away. And you will tend not to have dizziness. And what happens is the fear of having your blood drawn tends to be less and less because you don't have that associated faintness that occurs when you're actually having your blood drawn. So that's very important, not to have him sit up. It's got to be laying down. You make sure you let them know. And the blood drawer, they want to know that. They don't want people actually to faint. So you tell them, I'm a fainter. I want to lay down. But he needs to develop a closer relationship with this doctor because there are a number of drugs to regulate so he's out of pain. That's step one. I would follow their diet until he gets under control. And at that point, after he's under control for at least a month to 6 weeks, I would then reintroduce other foods. But there are many people with Crohn's that eat a regular and a normal diet, and they do just fine.
Okay.
You got it. This is construction season, so it's going to be harder to get him in to see the doc. But often, if he goes to a larger clinic, or he can go and get his blood drawn on Saturday or Sunday when he's not working, or earlier in the morning.
Okay.
Or at least talk to the doctor on the phone and say, hey, he's still not doing well. What do we add next? We can get him in for blood work, but I can't get him in to be seen because he's working. Usually you get that. Very important to have a relationship with the gastroenterologist with this. Do you have a good relationship with the doctor? Has he only seen the gastroenterologist once?
He's seen him once. And we had to cancel the second one because he had to work. But his boss, because he just started a new job, so the boss, we're talking to him, and I told him we have to get him back in.
Yeah,
not worth suffering.
Work with the boss. Did you like the gastroenterologist?
Yeah, she was really, really nice.
Excellent.
Really explained a lot of stuff, and I went and ordered some books that she recommended, so I'm reading those. So
you know something? It sounds like you've got a good doc. Got to get on his butt. You talk to his employer. You can do this, and you can do it in a timely fashion to get him out of pain. He's going to be happier, and you know what? You'll be happier, too.
I will.
Take care. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Appreciate that call at 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, time again now to slog through the murky waters of medical quackery. Let's fire up another segment of Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quack it up with Dr. Zorba.
Okay, Zorba, tell us about how some people were convinced that the human body could benefit from a shot of some good old-fashioned radium?
That's right. Radium was the cure-all. If we can put it on watches, if it can light up, it'll light up your light. Radium ionized your glands. So these particular things, there wasn't just one person. They put radium in everything. They put radium in your butt to help your have bowel movements if you were constipated. Radium suppositories. They had radium in jock straps to help you produce more sperm and have better sex. Can you imagine in the 1920s, you put on a radium jock strap? Of course, years later, you would end up getting testicular cancer, but they never quite connected. connected that at that moment to radium. Gamma rays would ionize your endocrine glands. It was a wonderful thing. And there was wonderful. They thought it was the cure for old age, for disease. They thought it would jumpstart your body, would make you live longer. There was the radium incubator, which was wonderful, which would end up making it better to incubate your glands. And it was a Dr. Bailey who was really moving this forward. People had radium in their back. They put radium next to their heart. Unfortunately, things like the Vita radium actually did more harm than good, and it took them a while to figure that out. But my point here is if somebody tries to sell you radium, and actually it's regulated by the Fed, so that would be a little hard, the idea that radiation would actually be a salubrious for your body was quackery.
This is as recent as the 1920s.
Absolutely. You know, it's hard to believe, but in the 1920s there were quacks around. And you know something? There are quacks around today. And our job in this show is to root out those quacks and actually, you know, bring it to the light of science so that people not only don't lose money, but actually don't lose their body.
That's because right. We're the good
radium.
Guys.
We are the good guys. So we will take radium and we will throw it into the dustbin of history.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this segment? Here's your chance to be more radioactive.
Oh, I love it.
By helping out our show, just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413, our number. 800-462-7413. And before we head out, Zorba, let's tackle a listener email. This one came to us from Randy in Sunrise, Minnesota. Dr. Zorba, could you please talk about the apple cider vinegar diet? My wife and I have been taking it with 6 to 8 ounces of water and a big dollop of home-raised raw honey every day for a few weeks, and we seem to not be as hungry as prior to the diet.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, I mean, it's the diet du jour. Apple cider vinegar comes up probably every 3 to 5 years. Started with a guy named Jarvis who wrote a book which was Folk Remedies in Vermont, and he actually manufactured honey and vinegar called Honeygar, and then said, this is actually going to give you a long life. And the feds came in, this is back in the 50s, and said, you can't do that. You can talk about it, but you can't claim it on the bottle. And lo and behold, he stopped that, but made a bunch of money lecturing and other things. So, hey, if it reduces your hunger, by all means, do it. It's an old folk remedy that a lot of people like. And the point is, if you like it, I would definitely do it. How it works, I don't have any idea. But you know, in America, it's one diet after another. And unfortunately, the problem is, no matter what diet we're on, we just keep on gaining weight.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba. He's always happy to help. Just post it to our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week,
Zorba. Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or, of course, through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Colbert. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more Zorba Pastor on Your Health, including episodes, recipes, and tips mentioned on the program, visit ZorbaPastor.org. This year, we're celebrating the show's 25th anniversary, and we want to hear from you. How has Zorba helped you out? What have you learned from the show over the years? Leave us a message at 800-462-7413.